County cricket, international cricket, test cricket, franchise cricket, red ball, white ball, 100-ball cricket. At The Cricketer, we care about the cricket you love. And that's why we've launched a brand new app built for fans of the English game. Download The Cricketer app and sign up to our Access All Areas Pass to receive agenda-setting journalism and illuminating storytelling straight to your phone. The latest news from the England camps, a dedicated daily service for fans of the 18 first-class counties, and committed coverage of women's cricket. Download the app today and enjoy 1 month of free unlimited access. The Cricketer. We care about the cricket you love.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast in association with our friends at Bear Crickets. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left for today's very special episode of TCCP is none other than Leicestershire and former Warwickshire seam sensation, Chris Wright. So Chris, first things first, mate, thank you very much for joining me here on the podcast today. It's an absolute pleasure to get you on for a chat about all things county cricket. I have to ask, mate, how's your day been so far?
No, I'm good, thanks, actually. I've had had a busy sort of pre-season, sorting loads of stuff out. I think most cricketers tend to try and get all their sort of off-field stuff in place, you know what I mean, before March. And so it's all coming together for me now. So, no, I'm happy. I had a good day, good productive day.
Well, that is fantastic to hear, to be honest, righty. And in terms of the preparation, because I know the Leicestershire fans out there will want to learn a bit more about this, how has your off-season been? Are you feeling good heading into this upcoming county season?
Well, I'm actually, I'm just recovering from COVID. So other than that, it's been amazing. The team are actually out in Spain now, but I'm at home. So we feel, although the weather looks better in England than it is in Spain at the minute, looking at the photos I'm seeing. But all good, thanks. It's gone very well.
Oh, that is absolutely fantastic, right? It really is. You mentioned that pre-season tour. Obviously, it's a shame to miss that, but they had a sandstorm or something, didn't they, at Desert Springs?
Yeah, some kind of storm Celia or something like that. Literally everywhere looks like it's, it looks like some kind of post-apocalypse film kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? It's like this eerie red sky everywhere and stuff. And I think it may have even rained as well, which is, you know, not ideal when you're obviously looking to get outdoors for the first time. I think the facilities there look amazing. It's just maybe the weather's a bit questionable. But they seem to be having fun, though. I think they've been in the pool and all that sort of stuff. So they're not letting it get to them.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of Instagram posts from the Leicestershire boys and the Derbyshire lads, actually, over the past few days. Plenty of hashtag no filters with that orange-red apocalyptic scene, as you mentioned it. I mean, it's absolutely crazy, to be honest, for a pre-season tour. But yeah, here in England, it's absolutely beautiful today, isn't it? Here in the Midlands, absolutely cracking the flags in Warwickshire in particular. So yeah, hopefully all goes well for the season. We don't have any rain. That's a massive ask. Obviously, we'll have some at some point in the season. But for April the 7th, I'm begging that the rain gods are favourable. I do not want to go to Edgbaston on that first day of the season. Or wet, cold, miserable. I'm just hoping that's a very, very nice day. As are you, I'm guessing, as well, Royce.
Well, I think there's talk of a heat wave, I think, isn't it?
Oh.
Apparently so. I don't mind a little bit of rain, you know what I mean? Keep the ball moving around. I do like the heat, so hopefully we have a nice, you know, warm, dry summer. Absolutely, I'm completely with you.
100%. But fortunately, Royce, we aren't here to discuss the British weather as much as we probably could, because it is a major talking point, isn't it, in this country. When it's hot, we say it's too hot. When it's too cold, we say it's far too cold. It's winter, it's too icy. We're never happy with the weather here in this country, but fortunately for you as the listeners, we aren't here to discuss the trials and tribulations of the weather here in England and Wales. Instead, we're here to talk about your cricketing journey, Chris. And with any journey, any tale, any story, they all have one thing in common, and that is, of course, an origin. So, Chris, what were your first ever memories of cricket, either playing or watching this spectacular game?
I think most of the people you have on the podcast seem to say a similar thing. Like, it's kind of a family inherited thing. I can certainly remember, you know, just being a kid running around watching my dad, and, well, not so much watching him, but just being there while he was playing and, you know, running around with all my mates and stuff. I can also, because I had an idea of some of the questions you'd ask, I can remember getting up early and watching the World Cup in India and Sri Lanka. And I think it was 96 or something like that.
Yes, it was. With obviously Arjuna Ranatunga lifting it for Sri Lanka.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember getting up early watching that. I remember there was an England tour to Australia. We've actually had Phil De Freitas working with us in the past couple of weeks. I remember a tour England had in Australia, again, around that time, probably a bit earlier. I think when Darren Goff kind of exploded onto the scene. So maybe that was even a year or so before. That's in terms of watching it and stuff like that. But very much playing-wise, just a family thing. You know what I mean? Watching Dad ended up playing, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And it is a common occurrence here on the podcast, but I always say it's a very nice route into the game when you do have that family influence, that community, almost driven path into the game. I think it's fantastic, to be honest, and quite clearly that is a very popular route into the game for a lot of cricketers in this country. To be honest, I can't say the same thing, actually. No one in my family really likes the game. I'm almost like the unique one in the family. My aunt loves international cricket, but county cricket, not really into it. So, yeah, basically, it's just me turning up to Edgbaston week in, week out during the summer. But it's just a fantastic game, isn't it? It's just a game which I always think is a fantastic metaphor for life itself. Cricket has taught me so much. It's taught so many people so many important life lessons. Because, you know, in particular in the longer formats, you're going to have great days. You're going to have disappointments. But it's all about riding the wave. And that is what I absolutely love about this game. And Chris, actually, that brings me nicely on to another question I had before we talk about influences, role models, and your journey into county cricket in particular. What is it about cricket that's kept you coming back year in, year out? Why does Chris Wright love the game of cricket so much?
Great question. I like the fact that there's all kinds of different factors, and it's almost like a puzzle to solve. You've got the mental side of the game, the physical side, then obviously you've got the actual kind of the skills themselves, which are completely varied. Do you know what I mean? That's why I think when you watch cricket, you see so many different types of people playing it. Do you know what I mean? So I just think it's a game potentially everyone can enjoy a certain aspect of. From my point of view as a bowler, I kind of enjoy, you're in control, aren't you, with the ball? You're the first person to sort of act. Quite enjoy the idea of, it's quite a solvable. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying I have solved it at all. I think James Anderson solved it. But I like the fact that there you can keep adding little things. And yeah, I think that's what keeps me interested in the game for sure.
100%. I'm quite similar, to be honest, in terms of my thinking. And you mentioned about the puzzle, which can be solved, but in a way, it can't ever be 100% solved, can it? And that's what I think I like about cricket as well. It's the fact that there's so many different factors in terms of the weather, in terms of pitch conditions, the condition of the ball, the types of bowlers. And not only that, the fact that I love about cricket as well is that you've got so many different archetypes. So in football, you wouldn't have a Darren Stevens playing at the age of 45. You wouldn't have a Mark Cosgrove or a Raheem Cornwall. That's what I like about cricket. It's the fact that anybody can play this game to a really high level and a high standard. Mm. And it's just kept me coming back year in, year out. I've been watching cricket since 2008. First Warwickshire game was 2009, which was heavily rained out as well. Might I just add, Chris, goodness me, 17 overs in a 40 overs per side game. And I didn't even get to see Warwickshire bats. I mean, to be honest, I should have been a Glamorgan fan, because they're the only team I actually got to watch bat on that day. But yeah, it's just, there's nothing like county cricket. It's absolutely fantastic. And in terms of those formative years, Chris, who did you look up to in the world of cricket? Aside from your dad, of course, and that family connection, was there anybody in the professional game, either in county cricket or the international circuit, who you looked at in those early years and thought, I want to model my game off of them?
Yeah. I used to try and copy everyone, you know what I mean? So I used to have a couple of mates from the cricket club, and we do like a test match, and I'd be like, quite often I'd be like Pakistan, actually, and I'd try and bowl like, we'd tape half the ball up and stuff, and I'd try and be like Wasim Akram and Wacker Yunis and things. But in terms of who I really admire, I love Mark Ramprakash. which is cool because I've had him, I've worked with him a couple of times. I've obviously never told him, but like secretly I'm like, oh, I love you. So I got Ram Prakash. Flintoff's like an obvious one. I like John Crawley. You see, these are quite old now. This is showing my age a bit. I used to love John Crawley. He used to just whip it through the leg side like a legend. Graham Thorpe also really enjoyed a lot. They're batters. Bowling wise, loved Courtney Walsh, Darren Goff, Jason Gillespie. They're probably the three bowlers I like the most. I actually tore my side once when I was about 18 trying to copy Jason Gillespie in a match. Don't know what I was doing, but I tried to, you know, he used to have like a really kind of snappy front arm. He used to drag it in really quick. I tried to do that and then literally, hobbled out of a match, I think, when I was 18. So they're the people I love the most, yeah.
Well, some lovely choices in there, I must admit, and this is going to be such a tough question. You mentioned some absolute legends in there. You really have, Chris, but if you could have a net session with any of those guys, considering you've already worked a bit with Ramps, so you may or may not choose him, but any of those influences, those icons, those role models, you can have a 2-hour net session with them. Just pick their brain. Who do you choose and why?
You know what, actually, I'd stick with Ram Prakash on the batting side because he's an Arsenal fan as well, which is class.
Great choice.
And then probably from the bowling side, I think Darren Goff. I think he'd have a lot to offer in terms of his skills and stuff like that. And obviously, he seems like he's got a bit of crack and stuff like that. So I think Goff and Ram Prakash. I'll continue just being a Flintoff fan when I see him on the telly on Top Gear and stuff.
Yeah, good point about Freddie. He's kind of transcended the game, hasn't he? In a way, he's gone into the mainstream pop culture here in England and Wales, which not many cricketers do, to be honest. I mean, we've seen that with Shane Warne and Kevin Peterson as well. I think those three are the ones who have really broken into the mainstream. Are there any more who you can think of, actually, Chris? I'm just trying to rack my brain. Maybe Phil Tufnell?
No, probably not. Oh, Tufnell, yeah, Tufnell. They seem like they've got great characters, haven't they? So obviously they're very watchable, and obviously then they've got their expertise and they're in cricket, which means people want to hear what they've got to say, for sure. Tufnell, good value, isn't he? I was at I'm a Celeb, he won, didn't he? Yeah, no, that was good. They're all funny, I suppose, aren't they, in their own right? That's what they've got in common.
They most certainly are, and yeah, that's why they, as I said, have broken into the mainstream culture here in England and Wales. It is a shame, though. I wish cricket was a bit more mainstream. I think that things like the 2005 Ashes, the 2019 World Cup, have put it into the general public's mind a little bit more. But at the same time, I just wish you could go into the street and people would just recognise an Ian Bell or recognise an Alistair Cook. I just wish that happened, or Jimmy Anderson. Maybe people will in the future with Jimmy. I mean, he's probably got some great gigs lined up after cricket when that happens. Whether or not that'll be this decade, we'll have to wait and see. He'll probably still be taking wickets at the age of 48, 49 for England at this rate, an average of less than 20. But we'll have to wait and see. It is quite strange when you think about that. And Chris, before we talk about county cricket in particular, and we talk about your journey, what would you say is the most strange encounter you've had with a cricketer outside of the cricket field? The most random encounter, just bumping into someone. What do you say that would be?
Oh, this is a good question, actually. So we live near each other, right? So Solihull's just up the road. What I would honestly say is there is about, I reckon there's probably 10, and maybe that's overdoing, there's 8 professional cricketers all living within a square mile kind of thing, including like Belly, for example. So you can kind of randomly bump into people whenever. I bumped into Tim Bresnan at Costa about a month ago. And I was like, when you feel like someone's looking at you? I was like, I feel like someone's looking at me. And then I twigged it. Oh, I was like, okay. So we had a chat and stuff. So bump into people quite a lot. The weirdest one I've ever had. So I just mentioned that Darren Goff was like one of my heroes. So when I was at Essex, I'd never met Darren Goff at all or played against him. So he's really good mates with Paul Grayson. And I think he and Darren Goff must have had a night out or something. And one morning I got into the ground. I obviously wasn't playing. I think I was only doing 12th man or something. But then rather than actually do anything productive from a cricket point of view, PG was like, oh, can you just drop my mate off at the station? I was like, that's rogue. Well, what do you mean? And he was like, oh, yeah, go and pick Goffy up from here and take him to Chelmsford train station. I was like, oh, my God. So I literally, I must have the most awkward, car drive ever. You know, when you're like, I was put on the spot. I don't like to be put on the spot. I need to get my head around stuff. And then I was sort of instantly driving Darren Goff round Chelmsford. Do you know what I mean? And he was sort of hungover, I think. I'd say that's probably the weirdest one.
That sounds a little bit rogue. As you said, I think that's a good way of describing it.
Yeah, I mean, for some people, they can handle that better. So obviously you've had Ollie Hannah-Dalby on here, haven't you? Yeah. Well, he's all for that kind of thing. That wouldn't sort of catch him by surprise at all. But I need that little bit more time to, you know, get my head around stuff. So that was a bit of a oh God, I'm driving Darren Goff around. What do I say kind of thing? So there you go. That'll be that one.
What did you say out of interest? Or were you just starstruck in that moment? Because you've got, you know, Darren Goff, he's a bit of a legend, isn't he, here in England?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, this is a long time ago now. We're talking about 2009. But I don't think, I certainly didn't talk about cricket. Do you know what I mean? That would have been too long a conversation to have had. So I think it was probably more about how his night out was, I don't know.
I was going to say, if you started talking about cricket, lots of laps around Chelmsford. Be taking all the detours to that train station, just taking as long as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I should have done, to be fair. I got lost.
Ignoring every single notification from the sat-nav on the way. Goodness me. What a story that is. And you mentioned Ian Bell. He's definitely my strangest encounter. I just bumped into him in a local Sainsbury's in a full Warwickshire tracksuit as well. I've never seen Ian Bell in normal civilian clothes. I've met him on three occasions. One of them, of course, is the charity match this year that he held at Nolan Dorridge. Another one was at a local driving range. Again, he's in sports gear. And that one in Sainsbury's. I mean, it makes me laugh now. But at the time, I was like, hang on. I had to do a double take. I was like, that's not Ian Bell. People just walking past him. I was like, do you know who that is? That guy has got over 7,000 test runs. That guy's won 5 Ashes. County championship winner with Warwickshire. People just walking by as though he was just, you know, some bloke. It was unbelievable. It's,
you know what? Yeah, I can imagine, because it is a weird, like I said, it's a weird area. It's a cricket mad area, actually, Solihull. I don't know. Like I said, there's loads of cricket clubs and they're all thriving. And there's loads of sort of professionals on the around. Obviously, you know, a couple of internationals, you've got like your Bell and your Bresnan sort of bowling around the place. And it is almost like everyone's too cool to just kind of go up to him and sort of badger him. Although it sounds like you did. But what I would say is, if you want a celeb spot, footballers and cricketers, I reckon if you go to Four Ashes Golf Centre
in Dorridge,
that is the place. I reckon Benny's in there a lot. Yeah, I reckon a few of the lads are in there hitting golf balls and stuff and trying to enjoy their, you know, downtime.
It's funny you mentioned that place. The local driving range was Four Ashes Golf Centre in Dorridge.
Okay, there you go.
A very, very good spot. Good advice, that, actually, Chris, because I believe Jake Linton and Alex Davis were down there the other day as well. So, just saying, any county cricket fans?
Do they live in Solihull then?
I'm not sure. They might have just gone because people have recommended it.
Yeah.
Although, imagine with Alex. I don't know with Alex.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it was Alex. Maybe it was just someone else's idea. They've just gone Four Ashes. Good driving range. And it is reasonably priced as well for anyone wanting to come into the area. It's a good little golf course, I must admit. But for anyone out there wanting to play some golf, maybe bump into Ian Bell or Tim Bresnan or whoever's there. It's definitely worth it, to be honest. But Chris, actually, we've spoken there a lot about county cricket. We haven't really spoken about your journey, though, as of yet. So what were your first kind of interactions with the county circuit proper? In terms of that journey, what were the first steps that you took on the road to becoming a county cricketer?
Okay. Obviously, there's quite a lot, to be fair. So I grew up in Hampshire. So I did all my youth junior cricket there. I always did well in the junior age groups, albeit I was quite small, right? So got to about the academy selection ages at Hampshire. I remember having a net with the coach, and he literally out of nowhere was like, don't think you're going to be a professional cricketer. He was like, and he said to me, a professional batter would hit 90 balls out of 100 you just hit perfectly. That's what he said. I remember thinking, all right, kind of thing, whatever. So I didn't get onto their academy. I was about 16, 17. So anyway, that avenue stopped. And then I decided to move club sides to try and play for a slightly better club side and maybe get some exposure. I just improve in that sense and see where that went. And I got noticed by a guy called Toby Radford, who I don't know if you've heard of Toby Radford. So he's, at the time, he was the Middlesex Academy director, but he's coached West Indies and all sorts. He's a brilliant coach. But I think he might have been one of the first level four coaches, actually.
He's with the ECB, isn't he, at the moment, Toby?
I think he just did the Young Lions in the World Cup. Yeah, great guy. And I played club cricket against him, and he basically said, come for a trial at Middlesex. So basically, at the back end of, I can't remember what summer this would have been now, 2003, maybe, a long time ago. So I went for a couple of Middlesex second 11 games for like a trial. I'd moved club sides, and I was going to uni at the end of that year. So I was going to go to Anglia Polytechnic, which was part of that Cambridge UCCE. And so that was very much my plan. I was like, right, I can't make it to Hampshire, but I want to play cricket, love it. So I'm going to do the uni program. And obviously I had this trial at Middlesex. So I ended up getting selected for the Middlesex Academy. So all of a sudden I had the uni program, the Middlesex Academy. So I sort of traveled down to London from Cambridge and stuff, which was fine. And obviously with the uni program, then you had your first class games. So played those, did pretty well, to be fair. Then, and the Middlesex Academy, the winter went really well. The start of the summer went well, and it kind of kicked on from there, really. So, ended up getting signed off their Middlesex Academy onto their staff, and doing my uni cricket. So that's kind of I wouldn't say it was a straight line, so, but yeah, there you go.
No, but again, it's, well, I suppose no longer a common route into the game, is it? Because the university scheme has unfortunately come to an end now with the MCCU, hasn't it? So, yeah, that's a massive, massive shame. And actually, I wanted to touch upon that because we spoke with Lewis Rees about this at length, because he came through that exact same route. How important was that particular experience in your time with the Cambridge MCCU? Because obviously it wasn't first-class proper cricket, was it? It wasn't like playing for Middlesex or Essex or Warwickshire or Leicestershire, but it gave you a taste in there, I suppose. It put you on the right pathway into that environment.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's a really important system because people develop at all different kinds, different ages. And if you're only picking people at the age of 16, I think you're missing a trick, aren't you? Something in my case, but a few guys who are in that uni kind of pathway, well, they needed uni to kind of maybe grow up a bit. You know what I mean? Just figure stuff out. Again, from my point of view, so obviously we played at Fenners. It was a flat wicket, and we played Essex every year. I probably bowled more overs at Will Jefferson than anyone else in my career, kind of thing. And, you're bowling on a flat wicket, a guy, I don't know how tall Jeffo was. He must be like 6'8" or 9". And all of a sudden, you actually learn how to try and hit the deck, because you've got some bloke just panning your stop ball every ball, and you're like a skinny 18-year-old who's fresh off a night out at uni. It was a really important learning curve. And obviously, I think doing well in those games then also made Middlesex think, oh, okay, you can obviously, do something. So really, really important, really important.
Absolutely. It's all about putting yourself in that proverbial shop window, isn't it? To create and generate some opportunities for yourself. And you mentioned Fenners in 2004, funnily enough, the year that Warwickshire won their sixth county championship, that was. Mm. You took a couple of wickets in a game at Fenners. Do you remember who they were? For those listeners out there, you won't believe this.
Are we talking, this is against Warwickshire? So I think Trot was one. I think, oh, I'll tell you what I can remember. You've obviously interviewed Trouts. I remember batting, and I don't know if I got 50, but I remember being all over Trouts because Trouts was bowling his slow left arms back then. And him, I think Brad Hogg played, and I took him down actually, which was class. I can't remember. I remember Trotty and maybe Michael Powell.
You've already mentioned this guy.
Have I?
We've already mentioned him. England international.
No, I didn't get Belly out, I don't think. Did I?
You did. Those were your two wickets, well, Bell and Trot.
There you go. You know what? Actually, I remember bowling quite well in that game. That's a big deal when you're 18, isn't it? The uni game, you're like Bell and Trot. Well, there you go. Fair play. No, two good scouts.
Yeah, two very good scouts. I mean, at the age of 18, I was struggling to get one wicket a season. So to get two in the same game of those calibre, very, very good indeed, right, Ians? In terms of those early days at Middlesex, I suppose we have to talk about the debut, of course, your first ever venture into first 11 county cricket. What can you remember about that occasion? Just how special of a moment was that for you to walk out onto that field, represent the Saxes, and almost realise the childhood dream of playing in the county circuit?
Right, this is going to sound really bad. Really bad. I'm not sure I can remember which game it was. Was it Yorkshire away or Worcestershire?
Spot on, Yorkshire away, yeah.
You're all right, okay. I was just double checking. Yeah, that was quite nerve-wracking. I think it was a reduced game. It wasn't a T20. I think it was like a 40-over, pro 40 game. And it got rain affected. And I remember it being hard, yeah. Up the hill at Headingley at the time, and I wasn't probably fit enough and strong enough. I remember Phil Jakes smacking me about a bit. I remember it being kind of like, I think it all happened quite quickly, actually. So I can't remember a lot of it. Do you know what I mean? It was like sort of travelling with the squad, then all of a sudden you're playing, but I had no thoughts that I'd be playing at all. I think I remember driving home, like, all fired up. Excited, do you know what I mean? Down the M1, but not, so I can't remember a lot about it other than I can remember Phil Jakes taking me down and struggling up the hill.
Well, yeah, to be honest, Phil, in that game, we do our research here at the County Cricket Podcast, we are very thorough.
Expect nothing less,
exactly. We have a reputation to uphold, but Phil hit a quick fire 70, figures of none for 32 from three overs, Chris. But it was a 24 overs a side game. So it basically was a T20 in a way. And I'm just looking at some of the names in that Middlesex team. You got O.A. Shaw, Glenn McGrath, a man who I've actually met, Nanty Hayward from South Africa, Ajit Agarka as well. Goodness, what a team.
I've been so lucky. I've played with some absolute monsters of the game. McGrath was there for not for long, but a couple of months. So I played a couple of times with him. Ajit Agarka was like one of the nicest blokes. He was such a nice guy. Nanty Hayward, top bloke, scary. I remember being a young professional thinking, oh my God, this bloke is off his head. He was like really just an intimidating guy and bowled absolute rockets. And then obviously got batters like Oasis and stuff. So he was at that time really pushing to sort of establish himself as an international. I mean, what a player he was. Was Ed Joyce playing in that game?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Yes, he was such a good player as well. Lovely player. Lovely bloke, great player. Dalrymple as well. He emerged from that team, emerged and played for England, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm missing anyone off it. But yeah, like, it was a right side. Brilliant. Great time.
I can imagine it was, to be honest. Yeah, some incredible names. Some really, really big names in there, to be honest. You also made your championship debut in July of that same year against Worcestershire, as you rightfully recalled. And Chris, I suppose in hindsight, because that was your first taste of county cricket, how would you kind of summarise your experiences at Middlesex? How do you describe your time in a Saxes shirt?
You know what? I loved it. Because it was amazing. It was like, talk about being thrown into, how can I put it, into history a bit. You've got Lords, you've got the Seaxes on the jumper, got world-class players in your team. It was kind of like, and I'm a cricket fan like yourself, so I was a little kind of starstruck, actually. Mm-hmm. Weirdly, it all kind of went by very quickly in a bit of a haze. So I can't kind of Obviously, I loved it. I didn't probably do as well as I'd like to have done. Always tried my best and things, but I probably wasn't as focused as I should have been. Do you know what I mean? It was all a bit, this is amazing. And I just loved it. And I should have been a little more calculated. And, you know what I mean? I had to grow into that, definitely.
Well, exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because it was your first foray into the world of county cricket. You're going to be a bit naive. There's going to be some wetness behind the ears because you're not used to that lifestyle, are you? In terms of being a professional cricketer, you need that platform, the springboard from which to build your career off of. And I suppose the next step in that career was down in the southeast or the east, depending on whatever you want to call its geographical position. But you moved to Essex. Obviously, again, another massive county with so much tradition, so much history, so much pedigree. How did that move materialise in the first place, Chris? How did you find out you'd be playing for Essex County Cricket Club?
Yeah. Well, basically, so Essex, Middlesex, Kent, and those, that kind of area, they all used to play a lot of second team cricket against each other. And also, because I went to uni where I did, we always had quite a good relationship with Essex, do you know what I mean? We played them a lot in the twos. And I always did quite well against them. And I just got to the end of a contract and Essex were interested. And obviously I had a lot of friends that kind of, I say friend, you know what I mean? You know, when you just have a lot of associations. And I went to uni with Tony Palladino, who was at Essex. So we spent a lot of time together. And I remember Middlesex offered me, I think something like 13 grand and a job at Tesco's in the winter. I am not even kidding. And then Essex came in and offered me like a 2-year deal on like what I thought was amazing money. And I thought, you know what, I can go and buy a flat. I can buy a flat in Chelmsford. I can play with people who I already know and I've got a great relationship with. Hopefully play a bit more than at Middlesex. Because I think at that time, Steve Finn was a sort of emerging. And obviously he was doing so well. And so he got us ahead of me in the pecking order at Middlesex. And also, I think the Middlesex experience was great, but equally, I think I had to probably move to develop as a person as well, not just a cricketer. But so it came about, actually. I remember being on the boundary at Laws, so the T20, you have the home dressing room, and the sort of the benches were down in front. And I remember I did loads of 12th man at Middlesex under a coach called Richard Pybus. And he introduced a headpiece for the 12 men. And I was on this headpiece of walkie-talkie. And he was barking orders. He was barking orders down this headpiece. And we were literally sharing a bench with the Essex guys. And obviously I knew them anyway, so it was quite friendly. And I think I forgot to turn my headpiece off. And I may have sort of chanted under my breath, I think, at one of his instructions and said, like, oh, yeah, I wish this guy would do one kind of thing. And he, you know what I mean? It was kind of, I mean, it was quite funny, but I think my opportunities were a bit limited. I was doing a lot of 12th man. I just needed a new challenge. And the Essex one was like a really, really good one. And I really wanted to play for Paul Grayson and Mark Martini, who was captain at the time. You know, when you just felt like you had a good connection with a captain coach combo, I was like, oh yeah, I can see myself going there.
Yeah, it seemed like the right kind of fit in that moment of time. And as you said, it was for your development as well. And yeah, it's unfortunate, obviously, because I imagine if things had been different, Chris, would you have wanted a career at Middlesex? You've mentioned about Lord, you mentioned about the illustrious nature of the club itself. Is there anything in hindsight, any feeling that maybe if things would have turned out differently, you could have carved out a career down in London?
You know what? It's really difficult to say because obviously, as you know, I play for four teams now. And things could have potentially, obviously barring Leicester, right, at the minute, but things could have potentially have gone a different route, all of them. I mean, what I would say is whenever I now play Middlesex, I love being in, you know, near Lords for a week and I enjoy that. So I imagine that as a more mature player would have been really enjoyable living near Lords. Having said that, I don't know how much a property costs in Lords. I think they spend a fair amount of time in the car, don't they, the Middlesex lads, because getting around West London's not the easiest. But yeah, that lifestyle would have been amazing, for sure. But I don't think I'd have been the... Yeah, I don't... I think I needed to move to become the player I am now. In that part of the... Yeah, so I think it's a hard to answer.
Well, it is. It is. That's why I asked it, to be honest. I was just interested to kind of get behind the mentality behind that, because I imagine there is some little part of you thinking, maybe what if, down at Middlesex, because that's human nature, isn't it? What if things would have turned out this way and X, Y, Z will have fallen into place? But then again, that didn't happen. And here we are today in the Midlands, a wonderful part of the world, might I just add, criminally underrated.
Right.
Exactly.
It is, you're right. Absolutely.
You can tell that I'm from the Midlands, can't you, Chris? But talking of Essex, getting the conversation back onto the Eagles, you joined Essex in 2008 and literally in that same year, tasted basically instant success with the FP Trophy. So on behalf of the Essex fans, I have to ask, what can you remember from that great day for the club?
Yeah, so I can actually start remembering stuff about Essex.
From this moment.
What I can remember, you know, when you pick up a vibe, I think going into that day, it was basically me or James Middlebrook that was going to play that game. So I think our attack was, it would have been Masters, Napier with the new ball. We're forgetting another seamer, probably. You had someone like Ravi bowling, Tendo would have bowled. I think early morning at Lords, I think they gave the seamer a nudge. So I played, obviously, I'm really harsh on midders, but I think probably horses for courses. And then obviously won the... Did we win the toss and bowl?
Can't say I know about the toss.
I think we won the toss. We won the toss and had a bowl. Unleashed Dave Masters. And it just went really well. We actually had a finals day in the T20 before that. And I think the occasion got to us at the time. And I remember Ravi actually spoke really well. And although he was young, he had a lot of experience in some big games. And he sort of said, the best teams just do what they always do on big occasions. They don't get themselves up necessarily. They just go and do their job. And that, I think on that day, that sort of stuck with everyone. And pretty much we just came up with a typical Essex performance. Dave Masters, did he get Rob Key early? Or got early wickets with Napier and Masters. Then I came in, sort of tried to hit the deck, squeezed a couple out of the middle. Ravi did his thing. Obviously, I had Canary and Grant Flower being miserly. And then, yeah, knocked them off. Grant Flower and Tendo, I think, in at the end. Unbelievable.
Spot on, yeah. Grant Flower, 70 not out. Goodness me. What a cricketer. Again, talking about underrated. He's up there, isn't he?
He is the best fielder I think I've played with. Like, off his own bowling, you've never seen anyone scrap harder and like win that kind of... Yeah, he was amazing. He used to field always facing the sun at Chelmsford. So that's the other side to the pavilion. Just stare into the sun with his shades on and just field the house down. He was an absolute beast. And then he used to used to hit the pockets for fun. Just unbelievable performer. I don't know if it was that night he fell in the River Cam, not the river, the River Chelmer, on a night out afterwards though.
How did he manage that?
Well, he basically there was a shortcut into town from Pavilion, sort of across the river. And you basically walk along the river, but the river had sort of like blocks or slabs, like stepping stones, and he thought it was a path, so he just basically walked and there was nothing there and just ended up in the river, basically. Yeah, good times.
Sound like it, to be honest.
I wasn't
expecting that story, to be honest. That'd have been absolutely hilarious to see live as well. Goodness,
it was
me.
One of the best things I've ever seen, actually, thinking about it. I think there was about five of us who were walking in. Obviously, Had was, you know, he was well-dressed. And I think he ended up having to go back to Martini's house to get some clothes, but he had them brought to him. I think it was a shamble. He was a shambles that night, but he'd earned it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To be fair,
He most certainly had, yeah, with that performance. And yeah, his brother wasn't a bad cricketer either, to be honest, Andy. Yeah, not half bad at all.
And I never played with Andy, to be fair.
Great cricketer, though.
Yeah.
And a cracking coach.
Yeah. Not had much exposure to him, but rock solid. Two good guys, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Two absolute legends of cricket in Zimbabwe. And Chris, on that day, you took 2 for 36 from your 8 overs. You know exactly what the next question is going to be. Can you remember who they were?
I can. So two good ones.
Very good ones.
Stevens and Van Yarsveld. So two very good poles. I remember that, actually. I remember chatting to Graham Gooch after the game. He was like, I think he might have bowled a little short. I'd be like, come on, Gooch. I'm like, you are a legend. But come on, I've got two big wickets here. And Van Yarsveld was out court trying to pull a ball he probably shouldn't have. So I reckon I was sort of spot on with my heavy lengths, to be fair. But really pleased with those two wickets.
As you should be. And what a day that was for Essex as a club. 5-wicket victory at the home of cricket against Kent. FP Trophy in the bag. Another one to add to the trophy cabinet down in Chelmsford. Yeah, I can imagine that a lot of Essex fans look back on that day with great fondness indeed. And Chris, in terms of your time down in Essex, before we talk about a certain Midlands county, which will take up a good chunk of this podcast, I've absolutely no doubt about that. Just a similar question to the one asked before about Middlesex. How exactly would you detail your experiences down in Chelmsford? And again, going on to that overarching theme, how important was that stage of your life in terms of developing the Chris Wright, the cricketer that we've seen today?
It was an amazing time. So what I think Essex were really, really good at, actually, was they had that sort of scrappy side. I'm talking mainly white ball cricket here. They had a real sort of scrappy side to them where, you know, we thought we could chase down any total. And even better, we could post a score and then just scrap and do whatever. Because Chelmsford was quite small, quite flat. But we were really good at posting a score and then just making it horrible for the team chasing and sort of winning games in that sense. So I think that kind of winning mentality and that scrappiness, definitely something I've taken forward. Winning is a habit, you know what I mean? And I think definitely with white ball cricket at the time, yeah, Essex had it. Put a lot of focus on it. I just really enjoyed it. You know what I mean? I lived near the ground, playing with all my mates. It was just a fantastic time, for sure. I mean, I think, that was an interesting time where I left there. I'm sure we'll sort of get to it. I don't really know. I think maybe in their opinion, they thought maybe I'd stagnated a bit, albeit, I wouldn't agree with that. I think actually, this is before leaving, so this is like 2011, I was performing quite, actually really well, albeit a lot of it was in the twos at that time. And I think at that point, it was sort of, when I came to getting my contract sort of sorted in 2011, which is when I left, I think it was probably a me or Maurice Chambers kind of situation. And that, you know, that's sport, that's what happens. And obviously they went with Moz, who was a bit younger, had a lot of raw ingredients and stuff, and I think maybe they thought I might have kicked on a little more, for whatever reason ended up leaving.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, actually, Chris, because this might be a difficult question to answer, but why do you think Essex didn't actually work out, I suppose, after those four seasons? Why do you think the club ultimately made that decision? You mentioned there about Maurice Chambers, an excellent bowler in his own right, but why do you think that the club themselves at that moment decided not to choose you as the next player going forward?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, looking inwardly, I think probably they think I probably should have kicked on a bit more. I think maybe at that point in time, I was still a little happy-go-lucky. Maybe I had that perception of being a little happy-go-lucky. I think also I had got exactly to the age where performance payments are cut off, which is a downside to performance payments, definitely. If they just disappear, then there's that. So if there was any doubt about me, then my age at that point was they weren't getting paid any of my contract anymore. Do you know what I mean? From the ECB. So it was sort of like, okay, well, yeah, maybe we move in a different direction. So I think that's probably some of the factors. It was an interesting one because what I would say is I've always really tried, and I think I do, and hopefully that's been proven right now by the career I've had. So I try to offer a lot to the changing room I'm in. I think if we're being totally honest, I think it was a strange one. It might, you know, I don't know the club's finances. It might have been a financial thing. I don't know. So I think there's probably a lot of factors. But like I said, we will get onto this because it's about Warwickshire next, but in the twos at Essex, I was doing extremely well. So I was in a good position to take that to Warwickshire, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. It is a shame though, isn't it? You know, when it comes to professional sport, that is just part and parcel of the journey. I think with a lot of sports people, not just in cricket, ideally you'd have one club, you stay with them for the rest of your career. But in reality, it just doesn't work out like that. Certain players come along, you might have injuries coming into it. They might be looking at stuff, for example, like another seam option. They might be looking as the clubs go in a completely different direction and have a bit of a rebuild or transition. You've just got to kind of take it on the chin and take whatever opportunity comes next, don't you, Chris? And let's just say with the next club, you certainly did that, because we are, of course, talking about Warwickshire County Cricket Club, a club which I need absolutely no excuse to talk about when it comes to this podcast. So again, like with the Essex transfer, how did that come about in the first place? How did you go from Chelmsford to the second city of Birmingham?
Yeah, well, without knowing all the details, so obviously you know Graham Welch, absolute legend, the pinnacle of bowling coaching. He was the Essex bowling coach. So when he finished his career at Derby, he came to Essex, where I was. And I remember him rolling in, and I think he had his Achilles tear in half or something in the last year of him playing, but he wasn't in the best way. And this kind of this unfit ginger guy rolled in, kind of hobbled into training. I was like, is this guy a new bowling coach? Do you know what I mean? I'm not playing against him. Little did I know, he was like unbelievable, but we got on really well. And I think he always rated me and, you know, took a shine to me and stuff. So essentially, he says that he'd been on to Ashley Giles about signing me quite often. And obviously in 2011, the situation arose where I was going to get released in September from Essex, but I wasn't playing, if you know what I mean, for Essex. I was featuring in their twos. So, yeah, the opportunity. Warwickshire had injuries. I think who would have been out injured? Oh, I can't remember. You'd know better than me. It would have been 2011, midway through the year. But they had their bowling stocks were a bit depleted. And so they thought, you know what, maybe this is the time to listen to Pop. We'll get Chris Wright on loan for, a month, basically, at the end of that year. And I guess it was basically a trial, let's be honest. It was doing them a favour because they needed another bowler. And so he talked Ashley Giles around, so I ended up going there. There was a bit of a hoo-ha, actually, because obviously Essex had to agree to let me leave by a certain day because obviously that loan cuts off. And then there was a hoo-ha about who was going to pay my salary, which Essex ended up doing but nearly didn't. I think they were trying to get away with a month's pay maybe at the time. But I think Paul Grayson sorted that out, which is obviously fair play to him though. He's made sure that they did the right thing. So anyway, pitched up at Edgbaston, had like almost like a trial net. I remember Ash being there, and I was bowling at, it was me and Andy Miller bowling at Chris Metters, just in a net at Edgbaston. I think whoever potentially bowled better was going to go up to Headingley and play against Yorkshire. Yeah, and basically I remember rocking up to the net thinking, oh God, this is like an important net kind of thing. And it went really well. And then so I ended up going up in the squad. There you go. And that was August 2011.
And not to sound too cliche, but the rest was history. After that fateful moment, wasn't it? Goodness me. It's funny how life works out sometimes, because if that net session would have gone horribly wrong, who knows? You might not have played for the Bears. The Bears might not have lifted the championship the following year. It's crazy to think about, really, isn't it?
Yeah, you know what? There's loads of things that go on, isn't there? Big chain events. Again, like if Paul Grayson had stepped in and made sure that... So I don't think Warwickshire at that point wanted to like pay for me to go there. It was basically a trial. So Paul Grayson making sure I could go. Pop probably having done all that work probably for a year or so, saying, oh, we need to think about Chris Wright coming. And then, yeah, it all kind of came about. Thankfully, I was buying Chris Metters, not someone a bit better with the bat. Do you know what I mean? It's funny, isn't it? Allow me to settle in and stuff. But, yeah, it went well. And obviously then, you know, that month just went unbelievably well. But from a personal point of view, I was ready for it at least. I was in good form, albeit in the twos. I was bowling with reasonable pace and swinging it and all this kind of stuff. So everything was ready to go. I just needed someone to pick me, really, at that point.
And that just so happened to be the Bear and Ragged staff, didn't it? And the following year, I mean, what a county. I could wax lyrical about Warwickshire all day long. Do it on the podcast. Been doing this podcast since 2020. And we're still talking about Warwickshire to this day, so that should say a lot to the new listeners out there. But 2012, a year which is obviously incredibly special to all of us here in Shakespeare's County, Warwickshire's seventh county championship victory. When you think of this great club, it's existed since 1882. We've been in the championship since 1895, and that's just the seventh time that we had ever lifted that immortal trophy. It's the first time that I'd seen us lift the championship as well. I wasn't there though, which was a massive, massive shame when we actually lifted it. In 2021 I was, so I suppose I've ticked that off the bucket list now. But 2012, Chris, before we talk about the final games and we talk about the running and we talk about the glory, the success associated with that summer, at the start of that season, did anything seem a bit different compared to 2011? Because we were competitive in that summer. We were right up there. Obviously, Lanx went on to win the trophy instead of us. But was there, I don't know, this kind of special buzz, a special atmosphere, this feeling of anticipation in that Bears side, or was it just business as usual?
Well, I think, to be honest, I think a lot of the groundwork was in place from the year before. So I think the team had that belief. I really thought, you know what? I think they probably felt like the best county in terms of, but obviously, Lanx won it. But I think at that point, Warwickshire, we were like, yeah, I think we've got this. So I think there was that inner belief going into next year, which you can't just get that. You know what I mean? You need to, how can I put it? Yeah, you have it for a reason, don't you? All the performances have meant we had that. And then we worked really hard over the winter. I remember the S&C, Chris Armstrong, he beasted us. It was like really grueling. because obviously you've interviewed a few guys who've been from that team, so I don't know if they've said the same. We had a really, really full-on winter. And at that time, very fortunate, had a great pre-season in Barbados, great bonding experience of just, yeah, again, hard work. Yeah, and then, yeah, well, that, it was just, yeah, it was that, I think it was the right time. We were confident. We, rightly so, we had a good age profile of the squad. There was experience there, all bases covered. But I don't think there was any different. And I can't speak about the winter before. But everyone just seemed confident, knew what they were doing. That was the thing that stood out.
Fair enough. There was just this air of confidence surrounding the side then heading into the season. Obviously, last summer's, well, I'll say success. We almost got there. We almost got there. You know, it was a flat wicket in Hampshire. That separated Warwickshire from number seven in 2011. But yeah, 2012, we put that to bed and we finally got number seven and added it to the trophy cabinet. And Chris, in terms of your stats from this season, I just have to read these out for the listeners. 62 wickets at 24.06. The second leading wicket taker in the championship that summer, behind only Graham Onions of Durham. And then your partner in crime, Keith Hubert Douglas Barker, a legend here on the podcast. He's got the best middle name in cricket, by the way, Keith. Keith Hubert Douglas, brilliant, but he's a lovely bloke. Big up to Keith Barker. Gave us some great insight here on the podcast, and a lovely bloke outside of cricket as well. But he took 56 wickets at 20.82. So between the pair of you, that's 118 wickets in a single summer. First of all, before we talk about the success and lifting the trophy, how would you describe your relationship, your experiences alongside the great Keith Barker?
Oh, no, look, great. Actually, mentioning Keith, I think the first game of the year was against Somerset, and it was a proper nail-biter in the end, which we came out on top of. But I remember him, I think he got Triscothic out in both innings, but particularly in the first innings, his first over at Triscothic was unbelievable. And obviously, he's a big player, Triscothic, and Barks just dealt with it like some just rock-solid bowling, nicked him off. And I think at that moment, I think, you know, I talked about that belief we had from the year before, that properly almost multiplied it. Do you know what I mean? It was like, oh, yeah, because I think Barks came onto the scene more that year than the year before, because I think Bokesy turned an ankle in Barbados. So again, little things make a big difference. I mean, yeah, Barks came in. Yeah, and he, you know, yeah, we were a nice foil, I think, for one another, because of just probably the way we moved the ball. I think at each end you had quite a unique or different experience as a batter, so you could settle, if that made sense. I could go on forever, couldn't I, Matt, Keith? No, seriously, skillful bowler. As you just ran out there with his stats for that year. But and also he had real good self-belief. Do you know what I mean? Probably one of his best attributes, I'd say, is his mental side. He's got a great competitive streak, confidence, inner belief in his skill set. And that's why he's having the career he's having.
Yeah, exactly. Hit the nail on the head right there. He's just a wonderful character. I love Keith. I really do. I miss him at Warwickshire, and yourself, Righty, to be honest. That was a cracking side, that 2012 side. But again, good things, they do come to an end at some point, just part and parcel of the game. But then again, we still have these conversations, and we can always look back on them with fond memories, which I think is fantastic about the game of cricket, the fact that county cricketers are so open to discuss these things. And I mention this a lot on the podcast, actually. Maybe a bit too much to the liking of some of the listeners. I do apologise at times, but I'm pretty sure I said this to Keith, and I'm going to say it again here. You two in that season were exactly like the county championship equivalent of Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad. It's like every single game, you're guaranteed at least 10 wickets from these two. When you think about it, 118 wickets, that's insane as a pairing. Right, and that's not even including Jeetam, who was getting the rough from Keith and turning absolute all sorts on those wickets. It was just staggering. And, you know, from 1 to 11, that Warwickshire side was so strong. The batting was so beautifully balanced. You had a great bowling attack. And this is going to be tough, actually, Chris, but I have asked this to Jim Troughton. I've asked this to Keith Barker as well. Was that the best bowling attack that you've been a part of in county cricket? Or would you say that one of the Middlesex or Essex ones maybe topped that?
Oh, no, definitely that. I think, yeah, credit where it's due. All the bases were covered. So let's take Chris Wokes out of it, because he injured himself pre-season. What a bowler he was there. And I'm not even sure how many games he would have played that year. But obviously when he did, he was, you know, a class above. You know, you had the left arm swing and nouse of Keith, who's assisting Jeets as well. Jeets, world-class operator. Just, you know, what a competitor and player he is. You know, kind of always led from the front. Brilliant, brilliant character. Then you've got Clarkey, who, I don't know, he just, Clarkey was great because you throw in the ball and be like, Clarkey, we need someone to go at like less than twos, and he'd bash away on it, on his length. Then you then you can be like, oh, Rick, we need a spell of kind of short stuff here, and you can get him to do that. He was kind of this, you know, he did a lot of different jobs. And then you had Boyd as well, who, bowled at times absolute rockets, getting horrible bounce off the length and providing, you know, that massive shot factor. Neil Carter, when he played, was terrific. Bowled with pace. And again, what character he was. There was lots of stuff covered. Darren Maddy as well. So not only did you have all of that, you had that slightly pace-off option, keeper up. He got, I remember him getting some vital wickets at Liverpool against Lancs, actually. So in terms of as a bowling unit, that would be the best because it just had everything covered.
It most certainly did. And you know what, in hindsight, actually, I'm pretty privileged, you know, because I've spoken to most of that bowling attack on the podcast now. Yourself, Barks, we've had Darren Maddy on. Darren Maddy, for a 3-hour-long podcast, 3.5 hours, that was a titanic shift. But big up to Darren Maddy for that. He's an absolute cricket badger, and I wouldn't want him to change for the world. Spoken to Ricky Clark as well, Mr. Vacuum Hands in the slip cordon as well. Great fielder.
Yeah.
Brilliant. What a team, what a squad.
You've done Jeets.
We have done Jeets, and number 25, episode 25, Jeets, and we're now 100 and almost 70 episodes in. G-Tan was one of our first ever guests here at TCCP. Still keep in contact with him as well. So,
that's good.
It's just a great club. That's why I say this about Warwickshire. You don't get this with football or other big sports like basketball or American football. You just don't have this sense of interconnectivity, I suppose, whereas in cricket you do. And that's why it's a fantastic game.
But I should mention here, then also you had Trouts as captain, who was... Yeah, wonderful captain, like just a great guy. He had everything he needed, could give you a little bit of a rocket, but had empathy, worked hard on the ball. You know, he was a brilliant captain. And bowling coach-wise, Graham Wiltshire, I've obviously mentioned earlier, just unbelievable. Yeah, brilliant. So the whole group was incredible.
Absolutely. And that incredible, extraordinary, remarkable, whatever you want to call them, in terms of adjectives and superlatives, what that unit achieved in 2012, Chris, what can you remember in terms of lifting that trophy? If you could bottle that emotion, if you could capture it in words and put it into the English language, how would you describe it?
Oh, I don't know. You know what? The weird thing was, though, if we're being really honest, we'd won it that first morning. So what I can remember is Worcester winning the toss and having a bat, but thinking, oh, I'm quite happy about this. The wicket had a tinge of grass. It was just conditions that more than happy to have a bowl in, especially if you're a confident bowling unit. And obviously Keith and I got five each. We were kind of competing. And it was just like, yeah. So I almost walked off then with Keith, having got a fifer, thinking this is mint here. You know, when you just, I don't know what we bowled out for, 80, 70? Something like that. You know, you've won the game there. And then Baron Chopper just belted 100. So I remember basically just being on from the morning of day one, being like, "This, we've got this. It's a matter of time." Do you know what I mean? So it was like this. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? There was no kind of surprise there. It was just this overwhelming feeling of happiness, I suppose, having put a hard work in. And then obviously, especially at that point after the morning, to share that with Keith and get a five for each, that was meant, you know, really good.
Yeah, it was good for us, to be honest, as the fans as well. Incredibly enjoyable. And what just put the icing on that proverbial cake, the fact that it was against Worcestershire as well, our West Midlands rivals, always makes it that little bit sweeter, to be honest, 2012. But the match figures, just listen to these. These are absolutely ludicrous. Warwickshire won by an innings and 202 runs at New Road. Keith Barker, 8 for 75. Chris Wright, 9 for 89. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, it was good fun. It was good fun. I remember in the second innings, or again, you know, when you know that you're going to win. It was kind of like, who's going to be bowling at the end? The lads were thinking, like, oh, want to get a stump and all this kind of stuff. And I could feel the momentum going, because obviously I was bowling at the time, and I could feel the momentum going my way. I ended up getting, I don't know if it was three wickets or four wickets in that one spell. But I remember getting, yeah, have you spoken to Richo on the podcast?
We have, yeah.
Right, I remember, bowling at Richo. I'm like, if ever there is a chance to get a pole and grab a stump and win a league, I'm like, Richo's back. it couldn't have been any better. What a player he is, by the way. And he was a great coach later on in the Warwickshire time. But yeah, that was a good opportunity. So it was an amazing week. Full stop.
100%. But I suppose, Chris, before we get on to the tougher aspects of Warwickshire, because the following season, obviously for you personally, with the injury, was massively, massively difficult, I can imagine. Just one final thing about 2012, because it's quite a profound and pertinent question, really, which again I ask to absolutely anybody in the county circuit who's lifted that county championship. How long did it take for the magnitude of that moment to really settle in? Because when you mention it beforehand about this club's existed for 140 years now, at the time it was 130 years since the club's inception, it was the 127th year that Warwickshire had competed in the championship. And at the time, you're one of just, 60 or 70 players to have been in a starting 11 and lift that county championship trophy. How long did that take to settle in terms of the brevity, the gravitas of the achievement itself?
Yeah, it's a good question. A while, you know, like, I mean, obviously the couple of years after didn't perhaps go. Well, I say 14 was a good year. Clearly, it was a good year. Third for injury, 13 was disappointing. I think the club probably, as we probably felt that we'd left a trophy on the table. So, in some respects, not until leaving, you realise maybe what you've, you know, until I left the club, you don't realise what you've achieved there. Do you know what I mean? A while until you can sort of step back and actually look at it. I don't know if that was the answer you were expecting or what, but
well, it's interesting because everybody has their own response to that, because again, I suppose in the moment and while you're playing in a professional capacity, you're not really thinking of that. But then I was speaking to Will Rhodes the other day, obviously as the captain of the 2021 side, and Tony Frost said to him that you're one of 8 players in Warwickshire's entire history. Will Rhodes was capped 530 something in terms of Warwickshire's players, and he was one of 8 to actually lift that trophy as the captain. And I think in hindsight, in retrospect, it kind of does take a long time to settle in. But when you do get these reminders, I suppose it's a bit surreal in a way, because we're still talking about it a decade on. It's been almost a decade since that summer of 2012, and yet we can still recall it like it was yesterday or last year. I mean, it's an incredible legacy to leave behind, and it's something which a lot of cricketers up and down the country never get to experience, lifting one championship. I mean, in this country, we've got 3 first-class counties who have never lifted one championship. And yet in 2012, you got to do exactly that, Chris.
Oh, no, amazing. I think it's one of those, when you're in it, you know, like, for example, like Keith and I don't walk around going, oh, you know what I mean? Oh, yeah. We don't. So you're kind of, you know, you get on, don't you? You talk about other stuff. So actually it's, quite often you don't think about it, and then until you're very deliberately thinking about it, like we're talking about it now, and then you look back and think, yeah, that's really cool. That was, you know, really good times. Or there'll be something silly, like on your, you know, on your Twitter or social media or something, we'll have like a time, you know what I mean? Whatever, we'll show you a picture, like, Jesus. Yeah. And then you sort of maybe think about it. But I don't think it's the most philosophical environment necessarily, cricket. So people are, you know, as maybe it shouldn't be, right? You're in it with your mates, you're playing, you're training hard, trying to be the best you can. And I think you should be thinking about moving forward more, you know, the past. Except when you actually really sit down, you know, you get to have a chat like this, or when your career finishes, stuff like that, you can look back and think, oh, yeah.
Well, that's understandable. Because you have to live in the moment, as you said, it's all about that growth mentality while you're out there on the field. I mean, you're basically fighting for a contract you're not thinking about what we've achieved. It's about what we want to achieve and what we're hopefully going to achieve in the future. But from 2012, I just have to touch upon 2013, because for us as Warwickshire fans, this was absolutely gutting to see you out injured with a stress fracture, in particularly at a time when your name was in the mix for England honours. So, Chris, I suppose talking of that season, talking of that injury, would you say that's the most difficult time of your career to date, considering everything that had been achieved the previous year? You'd got 62 wickets, you're in the England mix. How would you describe that moment in your life, and how difficult was that for you to overcome?
I think that and almost the following year it reoccurred, which was, so it was two sort of big years for me. So yeah, no, that was obviously really disappointing. I guess it's the nature of, or the way I bowl, certainly did bowl, is I sort of gave everything every ball, which is probably one of the reasons why hopefully people like to have me in their team. But equally, it did mean I was maybe open to a little bit, similar to someone like Stoney now, right? He tries his absolute best and gives everything every ball, and that steers you towards, I think, a higher risk of injury. I think it's a slightly different topic, but in terms of stress fractures and stuff, I still think people don't get it. They look just at volume of overs and spikes and stuff, but it's not just that. If you extend yourself maximally all the time, you're just going to, that's unfortunately, you're going to be, more high risk. That's what happened for me, unfortunately. Obviously, I played that game for the Lions, did a winter in Australia with the Lions, which was obviously a great experience. I'd love to have gone a bit further. Absolutely, if I had have got the opportunity, I would have fully embraced it and given it everything I could.
Well, of course you would, because that's the mentality that you have to have in the game, isn't it? And that was one which, as you mentioned beforehand, it's the one that served you so well in cricket up until that point. But it's just the timing. Just so unfortunate, to be honest. It kind of derailed the England hopes at that moment. And this, again, is a very tough question, Chris, but in hindsight, in retrospect, maybe in an alternate timeline, do you wish you would have got that chance to play for England? I'm guessing the answer is yes, but...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, I think you had at the time you had a group, so I'd have been competing with someone like I remember having a chat actually on that Lions trip with Dave Parsons, who was running that tour. And, people, so it would have been people like myself, Toby Rowland-Jones, Wokesy he was more of an all-rounder clearly, but Wokes, Mika, James Harris. So I think, and in Dave Parsons' words, he was like, there was room for like one of us to come through and try and play like a 20, 30 test matches kind of thing. We'll never know. I'd love to have had the opportunity and stuff. Unfortunately my body let me down at the time. But yeah, it would have been nice to have had the chance to have played and tried to kind of sustain that, gone that 60 wickets and backed it up two seasons on the trot, and, hopefully been a guy that behind Broad and Anderson would have been like, Chris Wright could add a lot to the England team. You know what I mean? He's got good attitude, pace and stuff to offer. But, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, Chris. Hopefully there is some alternate universe out there where cricket fans got to enjoy that. Stuart Broad, Jimmy Anderson, Chris Wright bowling attack. Goodness me. That'd be a handful for any international batting lineup. Crikey. Maybe adding a splash of Keith Barker as well. That'd be nice for us as Warwickshire fans as well. Get some rough in for Graham Swan. But yeah, it's just, again, unfortunate, but it's sport, it's cutthroat, and you can't do anything about injuries. That's just, unfortunately, part and parcel of the game. But I'm interested, actually, to know about your mentality behind stress fractures, because this is something which, obviously, is a common occurrence now in English Test cricket. You mentioned Ollie Stone. He's had all sorts of issues with stress fractures. I was interested to hear there that it wasn't necessarily, in your view, just about the physical exertion and the toll of fast bowling. It was also almost the attitude of giving it your all every single delivery? I know this is a tough question again, Chris, but let's say four young bowlers out there. How would you, or what would you advise in terms of those bowlers mitigating the likelihood of getting a stress fracture? Is there anything that you could maybe advise them on doing in order to alleviate those issues?
Yeah, so what I mean is, I don't necessarily think it's the attitude, but, okay, so Barks, for example, he's never had a stress fracture in his back, right? But he's never probably tried to bowl as quick as he could every ball. Do you see what I mean? So that's what I'm saying. So there's, let's say you've got two bowlers. Bowler A bowls 140, but it is 90% of his max effort. Whereas you've got a bowler B who can push 140, but it takes everything, and they do that. Well, then bowler B is more at risk. That's what I'm going down. So, for example, if Keith bowls 500 overs in a season and Ollie Stone bowls 500 overs in a season, you're more likely that Ollie Stone might have a back issue. But in terms of the way it's analysed, it isn't analysed like that. It's just analysed like they're the same. How would I help young bowlers? Obviously, the right strength program, 100% the right strength program. Being conditioned enough that you, I'm trying to word this the right way, being conditioned enough that you're not straining that much, because obviously if you're tired, then you're more likely to strain at the crease. Do you see what I mean? So I'd say that's where you need to be conditioned. Your action needs to not be a train wreck, which I've heard people describe people's actions as. Dennis Lillycamp once when I was younger, he called people train wrecks for fun. He was just like, train wreck. So as long as your action's reasonably safe, yeah, I think they're important. I don't think you should waste overs. That's what I would say, which is really hard. I think this is the biggest edge that I think batters have over bowlers in terms of training. There is a limit to how much quality training you can do as a bowler, because physically you need to be able to tolerate it. So no wasted crappy overs deliveries. I'm all for like minimising that. But equally, you can't underbowl. There's this sweet spot for sure. And I think that's where a lot of the research has gone, is avoiding spikes. I support that 100%. But it's not the only thing. And then I think, yeah, if your ball's to the wall every ball, which I fully support, by the way, then you're going to be slightly higher risk. But I would never tell a bowler not to go for it. Do you know what I mean? Some bowlers are better too. Again, Barks, unbelievably good at bowling in a really within itself and in a comfortable range, if that makes sense. So I, for example, personally, I find it quite hard just to kind of come down in intensity and, like, I don't say put it there, that's the wrong word, but Barks was very good at still being accurate even when he would come back a step or come down a gear, whereas someone like me, I'm not so good at that. I always need to have that high energy and stuff to complete my action, feel better. So I think it's hard. In this, bowlers know about themselves. It's hard to kind of do a one-size-fits-all. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there isn't one, is there? And I think actually that last passage is the key thing. It's all about tailoring it to the individual. Not every single bowler's the same. I mean, in cricket, there's so many different actions, so many different styles of bowling as well. It's all about tailoring it to yourself as a bowler, as opposed to a generic sense.
I would say wickets play a big thing. I remember one year at Edgbaston, and it was quite flat. It was really flat. It was like, geez, this literally feels like backbreaking work. Equally, Old Trafford, super hard, firm, square. So, you know, someone like Anderson had stress fractures when he was a bit younger, didn't he? Stuart Broad, I don't think has. And where's he grown up? He's grown up at Grace Road and Trent Bridge, which are perceived to be maybe more seamer and swingy grounds, which obviously means you can maybe cut, you know what I mean? You have to go, you have to go balls to the wall in those conditions. Whereas Old Trafford, I don't know if Sakib Mahmood's had any stresses or anything like that, but do you know what I mean? A couple of seasons in flat conditions at Old Trafford will physically have more of a toll on you, I think, than playing at Bristol. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Actually, that'd be such an interesting study, wouldn't it? To see if there is a geographical correlation between the two.
I mean, I think Australia have done some of the biggest research on stress fractures, and you can understand why, because they bowl on slabs, don't they? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a reason why. It's really difficult. The bowlers are built differently everywhere. Look at the Aussie bowlers. They're absolute monsters. They're big units. They have to be, because they bowl on concrete slabs, and you know, you have to bowl 85 mile an hour and above consistently for long periods of time. So they're bowlers. They look like they've been in grow bags from when they're a young age, whereas a lot of maybe more county seamers don't look quite the same. It's because they haven't had to be.
Yeah, it's a good point, that. In fact, that's something which Stephen Jones mentioned on our podcast as well. Obviously, he's very much into the biomechanics of seam bowling. He's an absolute guru when it comes to the art form of seam bowling. But with him, he mentioned exactly that in terms of your surfaces. He mentioned in the Caribbean as well, the reason why they're able to generate that extra bit of pace and bounce is because of the tendons. Because when you're in sand, it's a completely different consistency to concrete. So that's something which he's actually trialing out. Be interested to find out the research actually behind that at some point. But again, that's another fascinating nuance of the game that we call cricket, isn't it? The fact that your surroundings, your built environment around you can have such an impact on the bowler that you eventually become.
Yeah, I was going to say, because this makes me think about like the whole England thing recently. And obviously there's been a lot of talk about it, restructuring everything, things like that. But your environment is your environment. It should be really tough to go to Australia and beat them because it's their conditions. Equally, they should come here and find it hard against us. We go to India, it should be tough. So there's, but like that, obviously we aspire to be better than those countries in their own conditions. But I think that maybe you can't be quite as knee-jerky as perhaps we're being at the minute. So, for example, if Archer was fit, how might this winter have gone? I don't know. If they'd have been more sensible, England, and picked Anderson Broad for the first test and gone, you know what, we got these two guys who are unbelievable. Let's be sensible, play them both with a bit of wood and whoever else. I'm like, that. There's a limit to how wrong that can go if they're taking the new ball for you. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? Do you know where I'm going with this? I feel like I'm waffling a bit.
You're not. We've discussed it on the podcast at length in our Ashes review, and we mentioned that word exactly, knee-jerk. It was just such a spontaneous reaction. I mean, obviously, it's disappointing. It's embarrassing to lose 4-0 at the hands of our biggest rival. But at the same time, as you mentioned, Australia dominating their conditions. You know exactly what you're getting on the tin. England, let's be honest, didn't have the seam options which we would have wanted either, because you would have had the likes of Jofra Archer, Ollie Stone in an ideal world. We're going there with a fragile batting lineup as well. But then again, for some reason, there wasn't this same reaction to when we lost to India twice or New Zealand beforehand. It all came from the Ashes defeat. And that, for me, was a little bit of the issue behind where this reaction came from. Because if county cricket was so bad, and again, I don't want to divulge into this, Chris, otherwise we'll have a 10-hour special, to be honest, rate.
We can split it up into parts.
Exactly. But the thing with people questioning and criticising county cricket, this is the same system, these 18 first-class counties, which produced the 2011 Ashes winning side, which has produced a World Cup winning side in both the T20 formats and the 50-over formats. For some reason, as soon as we lose the Ashes, county cricket is irrelevant. It's outdated. We need to go to a franchise model. And Chris, seeing as you play for Leicestershire now, I know we've jumped the gun a bit there from Warwickshire. We didn't really talk about the rest of your time there, but we can always mention that in a later part, I suppose. But playing for a non-test county, what are your thoughts on this whole you know, debate, discussion about the restructure of English county cricket?
Yeah, it's really tough because you don't know. I mean, obviously, you don't know what's going to happen yet. What I do know, I'm literally where I am, I've got the fixtures and stuff up on the wall here, is the schedule looks pretty well balanced this year. So there was all the talk, wasn't there, about cricket in April and all this. However, in my recent experience, the best pitches of the year have been in April because they've got all that preparation time in March. Like, groundsmen don't sit there without the covers on in March, right? The covers are on. They're getting wickets how they want them all throughout March. April hits and the wickets have had a lot of prep time. The wickets actually deteriorate once they start playing T20 games 2 or 3 days out from a championship game because there's a whole day where they're not preparing pitch. It's just left, you know what I mean? So actually, April's a good time for cricket pitches. And I think the scores reflect it. But the fixtures this year, there is championship cricket every month. I'm pretty sure these are open to the public now, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
I'm not going to get into trouble. Okay. Yeah, every month there is championship cricket apart from August. Is that right? Yeah. Which is obviously when they fit in an extra tournament. You know, whether you're a fan of it or not, it in terms of financially and stuff, clearly it is good for the game. And it, you know, hopefully everyone in cricket has been the benefit of it. And I think it went really well, didn't it, last year? So barring August, there is cricket all year round. I feel like we had a couple of going back to the England thing, we had a couple of turning pitches at Grace Road last year. And that have basically been told off by the ECB. So we're not allowed to prepare. I mean, what do they want? I don't quite know. You know what I mean? Talk about can't play spin, you lose in India, and then you're nailing clubs. Like, obviously, Taunton is a high-profile one. It goes and spins there, and then everyone goes mad, rather than actually figuring out how to play on it. And it's fun to play in different conditions. That's part of the best thing about cricket. It's not like football where you pitch up, every pitch is the same. Cricket, everything is different. Do you know what I mean? Which is one of the real attractions, especially at club level. You know, you're in for all kinds of surprises, aren't you? So I don't know. I don't know where they're going to go with it. But the fixture list itself looks quite balanced. I don't see that. Peterson, what did he have a run? Didn't he? He wants to cut the counties down and you know, which I think it's easy to say, isn't it, when you've done what he's done. Very easy to say that, but he benefited from that, the county system being perhaps as large as it is when he came over. So yeah, I'm trying to be balanced about it. I think the fixture list looks balanced this year. Pretty happy with it. In theory, you've got Division One with 10 teams, which I guess the aim is to, ideally, it makes sense that you're picking your England players from that, as it's deemed to be the highest standard of county cricket. Yeah, I get that. Don't think that means you can't produce international cricketers in Div 2 at all. I don't think things are too bad. You can't change the weather in the country. So let's be honest, if you have a week of bad weather, the ball's going to move about. Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, I don't know. Unless they've got some amazing things planned, I don't know what they're going to come up with.
Well, it's tough, isn't it? And I think something as well, I've mentioned this a lot on the podcast, something which is immeasurable. It's intangible. It's not pitches. It's not the weather. It's not the Duke's ball. I saw that as well. People saying we should swap to the Kookaburra, which I'm guessing is a seam bowler. Chris, are you in favour of that, or do you like the nice pronounced seam of the Duke's?
Well, yeah, you know what? When I started, they used the red Kookaburra in the second team. It was fine. It swung and stuff like that, which actually I quite like, right? I'm probably more of a swing bowler than a seam bowler. So if you want to use a Kookaburra, yeah, it doesn't stop. I don't mind, especially. There was a phase where they used the Tiflex in Division 2. And I think they seemed aggressively, if you know what I mean, which I don't think is what you want. I think that's what you want to avoid, isn't it? to be honest. I'm a bit old fashioned. I could go on a bit of a rant here. I don't think there's anything wrong with the Duke. I think the thing with the Duke ball is it's quite easy to keep in good condition, which is what helps bowlers for longer periods. You don't have this sudden drop off after 30 overs like with a Kookaburra. With a Duke, you can pretty much always have some kind of shine on it. Whereas a Kookaburra, you can have some of those spells where you're like, oh God, you know what I mean? Can't do anything with it. A dog ball.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it, to be honest. I suppose that's the difference in consistency of the lacquer, isn't it? When it comes to the two cricket balls and, of course, the seam as well, which, again, has been in for a lot of discussion and discourse over the course of this winter. But as I said, going back onto that theme of the intangibles, cricket's cyclical. And that is something which we have to understand as cricket fans and sporting fans in general. The fact is, you can have the best domestic circuit on the planet. Look at India with the IPL. This is a fantastic example, actually. India won the first ever T20 World Cup in 2007. When you think of the players they produced in the Indian Premier League, Kohli, Sharma, Shikhar Dhawan, MS Dhoni, Jasprit Bumrah, Ravi Chandran Ashwin, the list goes on and on and on. They haven't won a T20 World Cup since the IPL's inception in 2008. Cricket is cyclical. You have these moments, these eras of dominance. Look at the West Indies side of the 1980s. Look at the Australian side of the early 2000s. And then again, another intangible factor is luck. You know, injuries. Injuries can completely derail a campaign or a series or a tournament, certain parts of the game. One drop can change the entire outcome of a match. That player could go and score 100. They could go and score 5. It doesn't really matter. But that drop, that moment, that missed opportunity could change the entire outcome of a game or a series or a tournament. That's what we have to understand. The English county circuit, yes, it does have its issues, right? And we do need to improve certain areas. I think that a lot of people agree on that. And that's something which, again, is up for debate, but it's a way of having a healthy conversation about it. The key thing to remember, though, is that we can have all of these brilliant things in place. And if those guys don't perform out there in the middle, all of that is basically worthless in that moment in time. We have to understand that there are other factors in the game of cricket than a Duke's ball, than the conditions, than the opposition, than the quality of our circuit. It's a combination of factors. And I think the day that we understand that as cricket fans is the day that we can start moving forward a bit more healthier, in my view.
Yeah, so Ollie Pope's a good example, right? So he was fantastic against us last year. Like really good, very very Belly-esque, like busy, very fluent, high energy, looked to score, and he just felt for it a little bit outside off stump in Australia. And I think although we were sort of joking about it on WhatsApp group, well, I really wanted him to do well because we're like, this bloke can play. But yeah, apparently a lot of the media are like quite anti Pope. I'm like, that's not the impression we got playing us. I think you think it's brilliant. Equally, you know, for example, if he plays at one outside off stump, or if Crawley plays a big drive at one that's not there, it's not county cricket's fault at all. County cricket should actually make you better at playing the ball around there because it moves more. So do you know what I mean? Yeah, I think there has to be that distinction. I completely agree with what you said. It is cyclical. And yeah, I think you have to kind of look at both sides.
We do indeed. And you mentioned about the media there. That's something which we're quite passionate about here at the podcast. I mean, we're not out there in the middle, right? So we don't want to contribute too much to the white noise. We have to understand that we're human beings. Cricketers aren't robots. They're not machines. They're going to make mistakes. As you mentioned, Ollie Pope, he can do it all at the Oval. He can do it all here in county cricket. His average in first-class cricket, the Oval, is over 60. He's an absolute monster. It's home ground, but it's a different beast. Pressure does certain things to certain players. Some will thrive in it. Others sometimes do fail, but it's part and parcel of the game. And you know what? We can't expect. This is another thing with us sometimes. We expect players to go out there and score these massive knocks every single game. And it's just not realistic. You know, you're going to have these moments, the particular series where you'll have one player like Joe Root at the moment, who's just going run after run, century after century. But that doesn't mean that everybody can do that. Everybody has their time. Look at Kohli at the moment. Kohli's struggling to score a century. hasn't scored one since 2019. Is he all of a sudden a bad player? No, he's not. He's one of the game's greatest. So you have to understand, and it is difficult at times because we're all very passionate. We all want to see England doing well, but we can't win every single match. But it's all about learning. It's all about the experience. It's all about putting those positive things from those losses into place and hopefully moving forward. That's all that we can do as fans because we're not actively out there partaking in the sport. But yeah, it's all very nuanced. It's all up for debate. And as I said, Chris, go on.
Yeah, like Leicester, I think we definitely want the England team to do well. Like, we watch it and we're rooting for them. But like, say for example, like Root, I'm so happy he's gone to three. If that had been a pre-Ashes thing, it's like Milan, in my opinion. So I've played with David, and he's a lovely, brilliant player. But he's a four or five at Test level. So I don't know why it wasn't Root three, Milan four. Equally, I look at someone like James Vince, who I think is an amazing batter. But does he not get talked about anymore? I don't know.
Oh, he does. He does on Twitter.
You know what I mean? I'm like, he's a serious player. I think Burns fundamentally is a really good opener as well, because the way he goes about getting his runs doesn't necessarily make it easy for an opening bowler. Do you know what I mean? He's good off his pad, so he can make you bowl a little wider than perhaps you really want to with the new ball. Sibley, for example, big fan of Dom, huge fan. He would have been hard to bowl at in Australia because the balls that historically he struggled with at Test level were balls that hit his front pad or the stumps, but the ball bounces more in Australia, so he's just getting more balls that come into his area. It's funny how it goes, really. There's all kinds of little decisions, aren't there, that you could debate, I suppose. But.
Well, exactly. It never ends, but again, we go on to that overriding theme. It's the beauty of cricket and the beauty of sport. It's good to have these conversations. Do they actually have an impact? That's questionable. That's up for debate as well. Do our opinions ultimately have an impact on the England side? Probably not. Not at this moment, because we're not involved in the selection process. But it's good to have the conversations, isn't it? And get it off the chest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoy it. And Chris, I'm just looking at the time. And you know what? We will have a part two on this. We will have a part two, because I've thoroughly enjoyed this, to be honest. And we do need to cover more about Warwickshire and in terms of Leicestershire as well. But just for the sake of the Leicestershire fans tuning in for this final bit of the podcast, we are, of course, not that far away now from the start of the 2022 county cricket season. I think it goes without saying, but I'm absolutely elated to be back at county cricket. Can't wait to be back in the stands at Edgbaston and various other cricketing grounds across the country. Chris, from both a team and a personal perspective, what do you want to achieve in the 2022 season? Have you got your eyes on anything in particular to achieve in this year's county cricket summer?
Yeah, I think we were pretty happy with focusing on the championship here, but unless you were pretty happy with our championship performance on the whole, because it was a strong group, and it was the first time, I think, as a side, that we've been exposed to so many like Division One clubs, and we dealt with it pretty well generally. So our goal is promotion, absolutely. Promotion from Div 2 into Div 1. I'm not saying that'd be easy, far from it. It'd be a great challenge, but that's the goal. If we can produce, the way I think with us is, if we can produce more of our best cricket like we did last year, if we can repeat that and reduce our bad days, or you know, make our bad days sort of average, because we had the odd sort of terrible session. If we can eliminate that and just minimise that, I think we'll be in a good position. We've got a nice balanced squad. That's personally what I think about us next year in the Red Bull format.
Well, Chris, it goes without saying, but myself and everyone here at the County Cricket Podcast, obviously wishing yourself and Leicestershire all the best of luck heading into this summer. I think it's going to be such a good season. I really do. I'm really looking forward to county cricket this summer. When you think of the domestic players we've got and the overseas as well, I mean, at Grace Road, you're going to have the likes of Ramanullah and Naveen in the T20s. You've got Vial Mulder, for example, and Baron Hendricks in the championship. And there's so many names. You've got Rizwan. Rizwan in county cricket is going to be fantastic. Rashid Khan's coming back. Warwickshire have got Brathwaite. Goodness me, it's going to be a fantastic summer and definitely one which you should be attending if you are in the local area. Get yourself down to Grace Road, whether that's for a championship match, an RLODC, or indeed a T20 fixture. But Chris, that is basically it for part one of the Chris Wright podcast. We will have to pick up our conversation again at some point to discuss Warwickshire and Leicestershire in a bit more length. But just before we say our final goodbyes for part one, do you just have anything to plug or promote? Any social media channels, websites, anything like that?
Yeah, I'm always up for a follower on social media. So I think I'm Life of Chris Wright on both. Or maybe Life of Chris Wright on Instagram, Life of Chris W on Twitter. I'm going to try and be a bit busier actually this summer on social media. So I'll try and put some sort of more behind the scenes training footage and footage of the Leicester lads on there. I just forget. I get caught up in the heat of the moment, you know what I mean? And forget to take pictures of stuff I think is good at the time. But I'm going to try this year.
I've noticed that, to be fair. A lot more active on the Instagram account in particular with the behind the scenes.
I'm trying to get on TikTok.
I've noticed that.
Yeah, so look, if you can get me some followers, that'd be great.
Well, there we go, folks. We will be leaving the link to every single one of those social media apps and websites in the podcast description below. If you want to follow Chris on Instagram or Twitter, or indeed TikTok, along with ours as well, you can find all of those using the links below in the podcast description. But that is basically it from us two here at the Counter Cricket Podcast for today's episode. To all of you wonderful listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.